Welcome to the 5 a.m. Master Scrum Show. This is our Thursday night edition. We have a great guest here. We have Anton Skornyakov, and he's going to talk about his brand new book he's got out. He's all excited. I'm excited for him because it's pretty cool. You got a book out there. And he's a certified Scrum trainer, business coach, author now. You can officially put author on your list of titles. And he's publishing a book, The Art of Slicing Work. It'll probably come out pretty close to when this interview comes out. So it'll be right on top. And you can buy it as soon as you go, oh, I want to buy the book. This is not a classic interview. Like, what is Agile? How do you do Agile? What's business and stuff? This is more about learning about Anton. What's in his book? We are going to cover what's in his book. And then, you know, a little about his journey to getting to his book and where he is today. So, Anton, please tell us a little bit about yourself. And, you know, share some stuff that's maybe not on LinkedIn or your profiles or your bio for your book or something like that. What do you got going on?
Oh, yeah. First, hi, Greg, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
It's a great morning we're talking. Well, what can you find, what you cannot find about me in LinkedIn, I think? And it's I think, maybe even relevant to the book. So, one of the things biographically about me is that I was born in Russia, I moved from there with my family almost 30 years ago to Germany. With everything that happens right now, and you know, even half of my family originating from Ukraine, you can imagine how society works, and what makes it work and what doesn't make it work. It's always been on my mind. It's not just since the war started. It's always been there. So I've been always active in nonprofit groups or doing voluntary work, things like that, in order to, you know, add my part to society working. And it does have an impact on my book and everything we're going to talk about, I guess, today. Because, one part of my activity as a business coach is actually not working with commercial companies. It's actually working and applying the things that we do as people from the Agile world to public organizations that have to adapt, to nonprofits that have to adapt. Actually, this need to be able to be adaptable, it's not something that is only useful for software development environments. And what I find in my practice is that there is a very nice synergy there, because a lot of the examples, a lot of the principles that we use in Scrum and Agile, they are you have to break them down and make them very simple and very illustrative, in order to help people understand what this means in, for example, helping people register or find accommodation or whatever some nonprofits do or even government organizations do, and where can it be applied, where can it not be applied. So there is, when you create and you break these things down and you then come back and teach a training for normal Scrum Masters or product owners who deal with software products, you suddenly have an amazing amount of great examples that are easy to understand, and they can then take and then, oh, they can reflect on what they do. Like you can see eyes lighting up. Oh yeah, right. That's what we do here, right? Because technical things that we deal with day in, day out, they are often very abstract. It's hard to kind of have an eagle eye view on what's going on here, and that was a long answer, I guess, to your question about my biography. So this kind of engagement into thinking about not just product development and even software development, but basically how can we be impactful in a healthy society, whatever organization of humans it is that we have in front of us, how this one can be impactful. This has always been driving me.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's always good to have that drive and everything. I'm actually teaching kids at the local elementary school / junior high school, and those grades. And I can track what you're saying. It's whole different level. And for me, I have kids that are 3-year-old all the way up to 13-year-old. So it's a very diverse. You want to talk about being flexible and slightly adaptable. That's what I do every day, or every Friday, Monday. Can you share something about, I mean, everyone, they love their certs and they love their trainings. Can you share something about your journey becoming a certified trainer, a business coach, and now even an author? So talk about that. We did chat a brief moment about your journey of becoming an author and where you thought you would be and where you are now. So hopefully you'll share that
Right,
again
so
with
I did
everyone.
not start thinking that I would become an author, and I've been warned of that by many people. Yes, writing a book is a very long endeavor, and I can totally confirm that. It's not a simple thing. So it's taken 4.5 years, I think, but the last 2 years were very active. I was very actively writing this book, and it feels like it's going to take at least another year or two, still being involved in the book, but not writing it, but spreading the message. So how did I get there? I started out as a physicist. Actually, I've done physics and maths in university, and I did part of it, which is called stochastical processes, or you could say random processes. And this is a very scientific, and it doesn't have anything to do, on kind of, you actually don't think that it has anything to do with reality until you come to a part of physics that says that calls itself political and societal physics, where physicists are actually modeling like voter processes or other processes, and you realize, oh, okay, interesting. But anyway, at some point I realized still doing all this theoretical stuff in science, it just does not have enough impact. It's way too kind of distant from where things are actually happening in the world. So I just looked for what can I do. So I became an entrepreneur. I kind of 2008 was the first startup that I started tried to build in Berlin. There were several startups, and at some point I realized it's not the particular startup that is actually motivating me. It's actually the way the different startups are built. So I became a coach for startups, did something we called Lean Startup then. In those days, Eric Ries's book wasn't even out there. It was just his blog, Startup Lessons Learned, and we basically followed a lot of these lessons, and I taught a couple of supported basically a couple of other entrepreneurs that I just knew because they were colleagues when I kind of started my own company first. And they basically asked for advice, and then at some point I just basically came along certified Scrum trainers. I just came along someone who's been doing this for 10 years, and I realized, oh, a lot of the things that I'm teaching to people doing this, they have been already existing for quite some time. And so I kind of moved down this lane. So my entrance into this agile world, you would say, is does not come from software. Even though I understand software, I'm not really a developer. I'm almost never developed my own on my own. I've always been a founder or kind of managing director, looking at the how do we sell? How do we market this thing? How what makes sense to customers? What will, this was always my perspective. So I also was quite often I was a product owner when I worked for other people, basically coached other product owners, created infrastructure for them, and then at some point, when I kind of started being a trainer and did this. In order to become a trainer, it's an insane journey. You have to find other people who are already trainers, and you have to co-train with them until they say, well, if I am ill, I would have this guy do my training instead of me. And that's kind of a high bar to kind of enter this thing. And so at some point, so when I've done that, I kind of I kind of understood the way I give trainings is a little different, and I was getting this feedback from a lot of participants. So Anton, you're telling all the stories, and they are this kind of societal stories. They're independent of software. So is there any kind of source that we can, you can point us to so we can read about it? And I realized, well, yeah, there's a lot of great books. I mean, there's countless books out there, and many of them are great, but none of them is actually taking this particular perspective. And so in the end, I ended up thinking, okay, well, why don't you, Anton, write a book which is not, the book is actually not addressing the agile crowd per se, because
Right.
I'm stating that I'm using all the principles from Scrum and Agile in the beginning, but then from there on, the whole book is completely not using any technical jargon. It's actually an attempt to make our principles, our tools, our way of thinking available to other disciplines. So the book uses kind of examples of, you know. Anyway, I'm way past your question. I
No,
realize I
that's good.
just
I was
love my hear myself talking. That's a professional problem of a trainer.
that's fine. No, I like the interesting hearing your story there. Okay, we've all seen projects at the brink of failure, at least wasting resources. I saw that as a this is how you have. What are they overlooking, right? Can you share how your book helps coaches or organizations get through that brink of failure part?
I mean, I'm sure you can share a thousand examples as well. Maybe we can collect them.
Well,
But
yours are
there
different.
is,
I want to hear yours in your book.
don't worry, don't worry. Yeah, sure. So there is a lot of so the main thing that people mostly overlook, and no one is, I do that all the time as well, is very often we just assume we know how things are going to work out. We overlook the little parts of the project where we do things for the first time. And whenever we do something for the first time, it's just there are some surprises that will come up. And when you build software, it's automatic because almost every software is unique. So you never, even if you're using the same library, even if you're using the same API someone else done or a thousand other people have done, you are typically doing it, connecting it to something else which has never been there before. So there is something unique about your product, something unique about what you do. And so surprises will pop up. And when you expect surprises to pop up, there is typical things that are kind of symptoms of organizations that do not expect surprises to pop up and act as if they won't, but they do. And those symptoms are different because it depends on how the organization kind of deals with them. For example, one of the symptoms very often is something we call crunch time. So a project would be going very smoothly and we would plan and analyze and then we do, but in the end, we realize all of those surprises that have actually been accumulating throughout the whole project, they kind of surface, but right at the very end. So we're not gonna hit our deadline, so we create kind of a war zone or code yellow, I've called it. I've heard so many names for this. And basically it's taking people who actually can do the work and have the ability to decide, mostly all the seniors, put them into one room, close the room and say, guys, you're gonna work, you're gonna make it, you're gonna make it happen the next week. Or this is I've heard, I mean, this is so standard that at Google, I think they have this code yellow. This is basically a standard name for this, for this practice. And this practice is, I mean, it when you've seen this, you know that in this code yellow, things get done. And you've seen that in this code yellow, people make actually very important decisions. And one way of looking at, Scrum or Agile working is, well, why don't we have that kind of working where things actually get done, but without all the stress involved and not do that. This is one of the patterns. Another pattern is that we just have, we call it the watermelon color of projects, like where people, where they have this big project reporting tools and they have the colors of traffic lights to show whether something's going right or not. And so something is green, right? It goes well. So you are at this big reporting meeting with big sponsors, and things all look okayish, right? A lot of them are green, and some of them maybe are yellow, but most of them are green. But then when you kind of unravel what is behind this big point that is green, you will see all the things that are red. So that's where the watermelon color comes from, right? It's green from the outside, red inside. This is another typical way of seeing the symptoms of organizations not expecting surprises to happen and dealing with them. And in the end, it's always a pain, because you will realize that a lot of the things that you do are wasteful, are just not in, and a lot of people who are working within a project, for example, sitting in a meeting and thinking, Well, we are negotiating right now about a lot of details about something that's going to happen in a year from now. And a lot of people know, well, that's not going to matter. A lot of the things that we talk about right now, they're not going to matter. But we're still doing it because, headcounts depend on it, potential power depend on it.
So how do you get out of that? How do you give us an example from your book? How do you you gave some examples where things are going wrong. What do you do differently in your book?
Well, so the book is basically proposing the one skill that typically a lot of agile practitioners are really good at already, but this book is enlarging or teaching the skill to any kind of subject matter, not only software or not only. And the idea to not have this meeting where you would, have this artificial negotiations or they're not artificial, but negotiations that don't matter in the end, is to think about, what is the one little thing that we can deliver in a couple of weeks that will give us some useful that will give us some useful progress. And the question is, what is this useful progress? And for many projects, or let's put it this way, I'm using a lot of simple areas in my book to show what this means. And I'm like the example of what does it mean to slice work. It like if we look at, for example, preparing a dinner for a lot of guests, and you can break this dinner preparation into two different kind of lists. The one list is the list of all the things that your guests will be able to taste, like all the dishes, maybe the drinks, maybe the dips, maybe side dishes, every little thing that someone can take into their mouth and say, no, I would love to have that on the dinner table. That's going to taste great. That's one kind of breakup, and the other breakup is the breakup of the work in the different activities that you want to do to prepare the dinner, right? To wash the vegetables, cut them, slice them, add some salt and vinegar, or and so forth, right? So the other list would be the list of all the activities, and slicing work is the breakup of work into those dishes. Because when you think about them, they behave very differently. It's a very simple example, but you can already think about, you could apply it to your normal life. Because when you think, for example, about what happens if if you're like you said, you have kids, me too. Like when I prepare a dinner, it can happen that something will turn up and I will have to attend to my kids and won't have that much time to cook, right? So I kind of planned to cook for 6 hours, but now I realize, well, 2 of my 6 hours are gone already. So I only have 4 hours. So which of the two lists, the list of the dishes or the list of the activities, is going to be helpful when I think about reducing the scope of my dinner? Right? I cannot just say, oh, well, I will not, I don't know, clean my knife. I will not season the vegetables. That's not going to work. What I can only do is actually reduce the whole dish. And then I can think about whether which of the lists items for which list do I want to delegate, right? And to whom? Like if it's my spouse and she can cook, I will delegate the whole dish to her, right? She could do all of the baked potatoes. In fact, it could be the other ways around, right? Or if it's my kids helping me out, I wouldn't tell ask them to do all the fried potatoes on their own. I would ask them to, peel the potatoes, and then I would check them. But that has far-reaching implications on how much they can innovate, right? When you peel potatoes, there's not much innovation space. But when you actually have to do the whole dish yourself, well, there is a lot of freedom. You can add some ingredients, you can add some interesting stuff. And when you think about this, like the two different kind of lists, the horizontal list of the activities and the vertical list of the dishes, you already realize, oh, this is different. But in most projects that we talk about at work, in nonprofits, government, or software companies, the slicing isn't as simple as with the dinner example. So you can see how it's useful, but it's much harder to see, well, in this 3-year project, what is going to be a slice of work that I could deliver in 2 weeks? And that's a very important question. And there are a lot of, software. In software, there is already a lot of tools and practices that help us with that. Like walking skeleton scheme or the tracer bullet scheme, the The Elephant Carpaccio Exercise, created by
Yeah.
Alistair Coburn. Like a lot of great stuff that has been created that is out there. And if you've been practicing agility, you know kind of things that you could do
Right.
to slice your stuff. You know, we have the splitting cheat sheet. And if you are outside of software, you're just there, and someone tells you, well, why don't you try to deliver something in 2 weeks and you learn from it? But normally, if you just say, what can I deliver in 2 weeks, you will end up with just some, you know, I could create a concept in 2 weeks and then I can show it to someone. Is that a valid vertical slice? Most of the time, no, because just creating a concept, it won't give you any meaningful feedback. You won't be able to get this feedback. So to your question, so what does my book, how does my book help? It teaches in this complicated project, it teaches people to create those little slices that can bring meaningful feedback to allow learning and, you know, start from the very beginning to actually deliver something and learn something as a team.
Well,
So
that
kind of
kind of
jumped.
answered my next question. I was gonna ask, what does it
Oh,
mean to
sorry.
slice work, right? How do you slice the work? So that's good. And I was actually thinking as you were doing that, I was talking about when you started talking about cooking, it's like you can have a slicer, you can make the vegetables, and you got a potato, and you got a meat or a salad, and the key is getting all the slices to show up with the plate at the same time, right? Because you don't want anything cold, it's all gonna be hot at the same time. I mean, if you cook the vegetables 2 hours early, they're gonna be cold as ice by the time. Or
That's
you
right.
definitely don't want the meat or whatever cooked 2 hours early and it's cold, and then all the vegetables come out all nice and warm. So it's the real key is that you slice it up, but now they all gotta show up at the same time, which is I think goes to what you said. You just I can do this, but does that really get you any value, right?
Yeah, and especially imagine you did something wrong when you've done the meat 2 hours earlier, and then you only find out 2 hours later when you
Right.
add everything up, and then suddenly you know, oh no, I have to. No. And that's what we call delayed feedback.
Now it sounds like we're talking about Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay and his cooking kitchen contest. He's like, it's all not right. Do it over. heard that before. So notice in one of your chapters you titled "Emotional Resistance to Feedback," which I thought was really interesting title. Emotional resistance to feedback. It's like I've seen that. Can you share any insights from that chapter?
Sure. So one of the resistances that I see in my work when I explain to people the general, you know, cognitive concept, well, you just slice it and then you can learn and you can get feedback. The actual difficulty in real application of this is, well, many organizations, they kind of generally easily understand that concept, but you know, they're afraid of actually getting feedback. Like when you are used to delivering a product in a condition that it is already polished, it's as if it's something laying on the shelf of a supermarket. But
Right.
suddenly someone tells you, well, you can gain a lot if you just show them, you know, your product literally partially done. And put it in front of customers. A lot of organizations, a lot of people in organizations, they're just afraid because they think people will give them negative feedback because the product isn't as polished as your clients are used to.
Yeah.
And actually, that's feedback. I mean, this is a valid fear, say. But clients typically learn about it very fast, and then you can, you know, move further. And so, when an organization is actually starting to do this whole slicing thing and actually starts learning, there is all the different areas where feedback suddenly becomes important. And in the book, I'm basically giving people three tools that I use most. They're not, you know, the only tools by no means, but the tools that I use most when it comes to giving and receiving feedback
Yeah.
in different areas. So one of them is it's the perfecting game from the clean not from the clean languages clean feedback is the second one, but the first one is the perfecting game from the core protocols, right? So if you're familiar with core protocols like check-in and others, there's this perfecting game protocol there, which basically says and you can use it for small little things, right? So if you, for example, if you think about our podcast right now, so
Right.
a listener after the podcast could say, well, how many points of out of 10 would you give this podcast? And And for every point that you do not give, so if you say it's 10 out of 10, you can it's great, then it's just perfect for you. But if you say it's like 7 out of 10, you need to find 3 points that we can do to improve it so it will become a 10 out of 10. So this way, it kind of the perfecting game is kind of to help me perfect what I'm doing, and it is kind of expecting the feedback giver to be constructive by this way. That works pretty well for small things in my experience. For larger things, or especially for things that you created as a group, the absolutely magical format that I've ever like th this works every time, but it's hard to take in the first like. When you do it first, it's co something called the Ritual Descent, which is developed by Dave Snowden, the author of the Kinevin framework. It's basically a format where, for example, you have a concept, you have a business model, you have your business idea, or you have a product idea, and you've developed it with some people, and you present it to a crowd, and then you ask them to destroy it. And you turn around, they do not see your face. Or if you do it online, you basically turn off your camera and your mic, and you just take notes while these people talk to each other, trying to like you ask them really. Imagine this idea is the kind of the highest risk that there is in your career. Imagine you have to destroy it. Please find all the weak points you can, and then they will find a lot of weak points, and some of the weak points will be things that you think, well, they misunderstood the idea or. They may be not qualified to comment on something. That's fine. They're just gonna destroy it with every. They're just gonna go at it with everything they have, and that's really helpful to you because you will then note down whatever is helpful, and then after like 4 or 5 minutes, you say thank you so thank you very much, and then move on. And
I
suddenly you
like that.
got, yeah. It, suddenly you got so many things, and what makes it easy is the ritualness part. So everyone knows it's a ritual. It's not about, anyone destroying an idea of a friend. It's a ritual that we're playing with each other.
It's to help prepare the other person. I mean, once you get there, you're helping the other person, the other group of people, be prepared for whatever could come down the pike, which we said change happens, stuff happens, right? So vertically slicing your project, and I'm talking about projects. We've heard this before. What can Because we always talk about here's this cake and you slice all the way through, so you get a nice slice of cake. I mean, that's a classic one, right? So, what new insight can we gain from this chapter in your book?
So this is the chapter which basically explains how to do it, right? So there is a step-by-step guide which is independent of the subject matter that you are dealing with that helps you first. Okay, let's start there. So what does it look like when you actually navigate a project in uncertain ways? So like what is the metaphor? Because that's an interesting thing. Whenever we humans are actually dealing with something abstract, we kind of need a metaphor that we can touch, that we can grasp. And so the metaphor that I'm using in my book is basically, what if you were a sailor in the 16th century and you were sailing a ship from, say, Europe to America? And you know the general direction where you want to go. You want to end up in New York Harbor, but you have no idea what is going to happen on your way, where the winds are going to blow. Maybe an iceberg, maybe an underwater current, maybe huge waves, dangerous waves are going to come your way. And
Maybe
so,
a sea monster.
a sea monster. Yeah, you don't know. You don't know. Maybe a sea monster. So what you have as a captain or a navigator of such a ship, you have a general idea of the direction where you want to go, right? That's kind of the goal. The second thing that you have is you have a map. It's not as concrete as the terrain, but you have a map, and you have a way of finding out where you are, yeah, using the stars. And that's basically what you want to have in such a project. So what you want to have is and that's something kind of what is laid out in this chapter. First, a very simple way to get to a goal that is good enough to start. So, what is a good enough way to just say, okay, this is my direction? Then, a way of creating a map which allows you to identify, like, set a direction for one day, because that's what a navigator does, right? So, he says, okay, now taking into account where I see how the sea looks like and where the rifts are and so forth, today we're going to take this direction. And then there is a process which basically allows you to deliver something in a couple of weeks and then find out where are you on the map? Are your customers happy? Where are you kind of? What is the movement that you've made? And so taking this metaphor into account, what does this chapter gives us? This chapter allows so basically gives you a step-by-step guide to vertically slice, and it's too exhaustive to do this here in the podcast, but kind of the main steps are, or the main aha moment is in my experience working with a lot of people in training is start with the risks. Instead of thinking what is going to be kind of a step-by-step way of you creating what you set out to create, think about what you set out to create in the beginning and then ask yourself, imagine it fails. How did it fail? Like, imagine yourself 2 years ago, you want to, I don't know, typical project people work on is digitalize an agency, digitalize some processes. People are using paper today, tomorrow they're going to use your tool. So imagine in 2 years from now, your tool is there, but no one uses it. Your project failed. How did it fail? No one uses it. It does not show the right processes, all of the different things. And then you ask yourself, so how do I prove that those risks that I just came up with, those risks that are actually there, how do I prove that they are not there anymore? What is the little thing that I can deliver that shows this? And suddenly you will come up with things that maybe do not involve that much coding in the beginning, but will actually help you ensure that you do not start with wasteful coding of things that will you will then afterwards have to throw away. And if you kind of begin with the end in mind, it's also very not something I developed. It's one of those habits of very effective people, very famous book, right? So, but if you start that and kind of how the method that I'm talking about, it kind of teaches you to stay there, to stay always think with the end in mind, and this way, just use a couple of patterns to reduce the size of what you're delivering there. And this way, you can always find something really useful, really worthy of feedback that you can create with a small team in a couple of in a week or two, and that's basically what this chapter is helping you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Now I'm going to ask you to every you talked said there's lots of stories in your book. Can you share a brief story or journey story that you captured in your book?
There's one story. So the stories of my book, they are very close to the reality, but most of them are derived from several customers because I'm not allowed to talk about, customers, internal company working. But one of the stories that I love most actually because it's quite impactful and it is kind of taking people out of the normal understanding of software is a story about an actually government agency that is responsible for housing homeless people and refugees. And they are, like if we just think about that, like there's several hundreds of people working there, and there is one team that is responsible for getting those buildings where people would live in. And suddenly they have this problem. There is a war break that breaks out, and there's thousands of people standing on the street, and they need to find housing for them very soon. And they have some standard procedures. So if nothing out of the ordinary happens, they would put in place a lot of containers somewhere outside of town, and people would live in this kind of really minimal housing containers. And this is, this is better than them being on the street, but it's not allowing them really to be integrated in the society, find jobs, and actually not be dependent on the government anymore, because that's what this agency is actually trying to do, right? It's trying to enable people to get as fast as possible to be contributing to the society. And so there is one idea that pops up. So why don't we, since we already have hundreds of buildings where people are living, why don't we look for ways that for people who already live in our buildings to maybe welcome some of the new people who just came to our country into their homes, even though they would have not enough space, not kind of the minimal required space. They may still have enough for them to live, but they may kind of benefit from each other living in the same flat. They may benefit from sharing a flat. For example, a single mother with a kid would benefit from another single mother moving into the same flat, because this way they could take care of the kids, while the other one is working. Or elderly people may accept someone in their flat who would help them getting through the day, right? So there is different scenarios that could work between people. So this is basically their idea, right? So the normal way how this would work in a government entity is there would be a lot of experts dealing with. So the architect would think where are enough rooms for this. Social people would work, facility management. There is a huge amount of experts that would think about a concept for this. They would negotiate, they would confirm, but there would be a decision. This would take several months, and then after several months have been taken, someone would try out to roll out this concept. So that's the normal way. That obviously doesn't work because people are on the street right now, kind of, and they have to kind of act. And so the idea what they're doing is they're saying, okay, well, why don't we try to house just five people this week, five people in an existing building? We just take one building and we just try to do that. We look for people who would be open to this, to welcome new people, and we would look for refugees who are open to, accepting not living in a container building but with less space. So why don't we just try to do that? And then they go and they talk to people, they create. They realize what kind of an agreement, what kind of document they have to draft in order for people to sign, and they kind of figure out all the details on the way, with obviously cross-functional team, kind of, because they need all of those expertises in there. And then after 1 week, they realize of the five people that they tried to house, only two of them or one of them, they actually succeeded, and three didn't. Right, but they now realize, oh, what we thought that with this thing with the single women and with kids, it didn't work out. They didn't want anyone to. But the elderly thing, that worked out pretty well.
So you got your feedback loops going.
Absolutely, and the learning, and suddenly you realize, oh yeah, and those things you would never have learned them in a concept phase, and suddenly, and kind of next week you try the same thing with two buildings, using the learnings from the first week. And so week after week, you actually house people and you learn from the process. And you, in the end, after a couple of weeks, you have a kind of a guide. You've created documents, you've created ways of doing this empirically, learned it. And, so for a Scrum practitioner, this looks like, yeah, right. That's basically what a Scrum team does, right? That's exactly our process. But just seeing that this is possible in a completely different area, those examples, they are kind of, to me, they're great, because I believe when people see a lot of them, they will realize there is a huge amount of application, a huge amount of fields where we can apply these practices where they are not applied today, where there is not even an infrastructure to apply them today. And to be honest, those government agencies that I work with, they only do that because there is no other way for them. Because the government, like the laws in no country in the world are the laws right now governing how administration works, actually thinking of an agile government, or at least I don't know of any agile government really. Like, many of them are actually interested in that, but no one knows how to do that. But in some places where just normal standard processes don't work, government agencies, I think, are looking for ways to do it effectively anyway. So they're kind of asking for support of people like us.
Yeah, it gets a little difficult in this country where if you deviate from your standard process, we're going to sue you because you deviated from your accepted process. And
That's and
that
that's the
puts a
thing. Yep.
fear that, like, oh, we can't, we make a mistake, everything's going to go wrong. Well, things do go wrong. I actually, yeah, anyway,
Oh, please tell,
I can
please
go on a
tell.
rat hole on that one. I heard someone comment about if you, I was talking about rockets going off here in the States, and if it doesn't work as exactly as planned, we're going to have to investigate the whole thing. Well, it's the first time it went off. It's not going to go as planned. It by definition, it ain't going to do it. I mean, yeah, we need to investigate it, but don't, like, oh, we got to start over from scratch. Like, that's where you don't get that. And we have a migration problem right now in the States, and
Sure.
I think they're trying to figure that process. That's why when you said that was interesting, it kind of related to what we're dealing with right now too, as well as Europe. but for different causes, let's say.
Well, I think it's a big political topic, but I think it's not going anywhere. This question of people trying to find new homes because
Yeah,
they cannot live
it's the
where they
mass
live.
migration. It makes things so, it's a lot right now. So it's kind of hard. Okay. So is there anything that you would like to share about your book? I noticed you have a training series. Did you create the training series before or during or part of the book process?
So this is a good one because I was asked. So Anton, how did you apply your own, what you're teaching people in the book to you to your own work? Like to the did you apply this to the book? And so the so I did. I did. I'm right now having finished the book. Or almost finished the book. It's going to appear in a couple of weeks, but it having almost finished the book, I realize how much more I could have applied it. But I've applied so and this is very much connected to your question. So first, the first thing that was there were just general trainings. Then I realized there is this, slicing work as a technique that I can train people, and I actually created a training for that. I run this. 3 years ago or something, I think, last time, 3 or 4 years ago, so quite some time, to test whether the tools that I'm going to show people, where the concepts, the stories, whether they work well or not. And well, some of the things worked and many of the things didn't, so that's the way it always is. So you won't find all the things that failed in the book, right? But then I realized I don't want to do it, in an individual training. I basically integrated those content into my general, Scrum Master and Product Owner trainings. So basically, there is a lot of so when you do a Product Owner or a Scrum Master training with me, you will learn the concept of slicing work, and we'll do a lot of things that are connected to it. However, once the book is there, I realize if someone is actually interested in not becoming, if they're not interested in Scrum at all, they're not interested in becoming a product owner or a Scrum Master, they just want to learn the skill, then me just, teaching them the standard Scrum Master stuff, that would, reduce the value that they have. So I basically said, well, we can spend, basically it's 1.5 or 2 days, you could say, just practicing those techniques and actually having people a space where they can come with their own project that we're working on right now, and just for the sake of it, just try to slice it with other people. And just do it, try it first on an example project, understand the principles, and then try to do it with your own project. And yeah, you can
Yeah,
do
and I
that.
think that's great because there's a big audience already have already Scrum Masters, already product owners, right? But they didn't learn your slicing technique. So I always think of this as a accelerator or add-on to their basic, because they don't want to
Definitely.
sit through a whole nother Scrum class of 2 days or whatever just to get you one slice of your background, right? So now you're helping that too. You help people that I don't have any interest in becoming a certified Scrum Master or whatever. I just want to learn this technique for my marketing, for my business side, for my whatever, small businesses or nonprofits, like you said. How can I take care of these surges? How do I do that? So I think that's awesome.
Thank you.
So lastly, how can people get in touch with you? Get your book, follow up with whatever you're doing,
Well,
keep track of
if
you.
what you heard is interesting to you, just go to slicingwork.com. There is a link to the book. There is blog articles. There is other info and newsletter as well. So you'll find a lot of information on slicingwork.com.
Okay. What about? Well, you have LinkedIn too. You're on LinkedIn. They can
Sure,
get a hold of you.
you can find me on LinkedIn, you can contact me. There is a website of my own company, agile.coach, in Germany. Sure, you can find me that. But if you are kind of, if what we just talked about sounds like the interesting thing to you, the specific website would be slicingwork.com. And you can also find, an email address there
So you
yourself.
can buy the book and then you get trained in it. And get some
You
real
can buy
life.
the
You
book, you
can
can get
get your
trained, you
vision
can
on it and then have the expert teach you and how it works and get it all to solidify and how you want to apply it and everything like that. So that's great. Well, Anton, thank you very much for coming on the show today and sharing with you your book that's coming out. You know, I encourage everyone to learn and maybe even take one of your classes to get a feel for how this really gets applied. Once you read it, you visualize it, do it in the class, and then go from there.
Thank you so much, Crook.
Well, thank you.